You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to SS Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 24th of April, 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. I'm joined today by my regular co-host, Sue Ball, who was from the Aryan Spring Channel. I guess we'll find out a little bit more about that in a minute. Now, how are you doing today, Sue Ball?
I'm right, yeah. I've got a new channel. It's called Aryan Spring 2. So there you go. Just re-uploading all my old videos, and I guess I'll get around to making some new content at some point.
Yeah, I keep getting lots of people asking me, where's your other channel? And just to remind people, there were a lot of videos that you removed off there, because they were actual videos, they weren't just audio, but we've still got the audio of those saved at archive.org. So people click your name in the article, it should take them to dozens of audio clips of you. Because I know lots of people like to hear what you say, you know. You've got good things to say. A good original point of view, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I find that to be quite embarrassing. But anyway, yeah, moving on.
Okay. Well, moving on. Obviously, we pre-record this. This goes out on Monday, but we actually record it on Sunday. And today is St. George's Day. It's the patron saint of England. And a lot of people don't really know that much about St. George. I mean, some people think that he was a Turk, or that he wasn't white, or they wonder just what was important about him. Did he really exist? Some people think that they confuse him with another George. An Arian bishop of Alexandria who was a really nasty guy. And there was one author a while back that tried to say that was the real St. George. So people don't really know that much about him. And I've done a fair bit of research into St. George over the years. So I thought maybe we could start off talking a little bit about him, because he ties in with a lot of British history that most British people don't really know about. St. George is known as the captain of the noble army of marchers, St. George the victorious one and St. George the trophy bearer. And he's also called the evergreen green one, which is where previous myths have become overlaid over the top of the actual life of this saint. And he's the champion of Christendom. And he was born around 280 AD. And he was born at Leda, which is also called Diospolis, which means the city of Jove in Latin. And that's about 23 miles from Jerusalem. And he was descended from a noble Cappadocian family. But his mother was noble, his father was noble. His father served with great distinction in the Roman armies. And St. George...
Oh, sorry, so he was a Roman?
Yeah, Roman well, he was Cappadocian. I mean, he was white.
What's Cappadocian?
Yeah, he was white, but he served in the Roman army. But his father was really served with great distinction. And then his father died, and an emissary from Diocletian and Galerius, who were the two emperors, they went to his mother, and young George would have been 15 or 16, and they said, let us take him on and we'll train him up and we'll have him in his father's place, as it were. So they took the young George, and he accompanied Emperor Diocletian in the Imperial Guard, and he fought in the Persian War with great distinction under Galerius. While he was in Persia, he founded the Nestorian Church, and he's also known as Nestor. And I believe there's another sect called the Nestorians that came about later on. But this original Nestorian church in Persia, he was the founder of that. After that, he settled in Beirut and he became the tribune of the people. And that's why in Beirut they've got the Bay of St. George, which is there. And while he was there, Britain just became part of the empire again. And he was sent as an emissary to Britain. And this also coincided with Constantine, the son of Constantius, who was another one of the emperors. I believe they had three emperors or three Caesars at the time. And Constantius was the Caesar at the time. And his son was Constantine. And his son served with St. George in the army in these battles in Persia. So St. George goes to Britain. He travels to Britain through the Irish Sea, which is why the Irish Sea is called the St. George's Channel. And he landed at Lancaster, and that's why they have the St. George's Cross at Lancaster. That's part of the heraldry. We're not sure exactly what he was doing in Britain, but obviously he would have been catching up with his old friend Constantine. And then we get Diocletian's edict, which compels everyone in the Roman army to start sacrificing to the Roman gods. And that effectively prevents Christians from being in the army. And Diocletian's edict issues another edict, and it takes away all their property. And eventually he says that any Christians will be slaughtered, they'll be killed. And we have 10,000 British marchers that are killed because of this. And St. George really didn't like this. And because he'd served with such valour and distinction in the army, he thought that he would be able to appeal to Diocletian, and Diocletian would have mercy on these Christians. So he went back to Lydda or Beirut, and he gave all his wealth to the people. He had a big festival feast thing and portioned out all of his wealth and looked after people. He was very well known for being charitable. And he went and appealed to Diocletian, but it was completely in vain. Diocletian sent him to Galerius, where he was tried in a court and he was tortured in all these horrific ways. And while he was actually there, he converted Queen Alexandra. But he refused to recant. He refused to give in and say he would give up Christianity and he'd worship the pagan gods again. So they eventually beheaded him. And shortly after that, Diocletian abdicated and he changed the law on Christianity, and people were able to be Christian again. And then there was no emperor, and Constantius died, and Constantine was in Britain, and he was the king. His mother was Queen Helena. She was the daughter of King Cole, another British king. So he was really the offspring of a British royal line and also the Roman equivalent of a royal line. So Constantine was proclaimed emperor in Britain, and he headed off to Rome with the British army and basically took the empire. And he was made emperor. King Constantine was made emperor. And in 314 AD, at the Council of Arles, he got all the church together, the British church and all the rest. There were three representatives of the British church there. And this also shows that Christianity had been in Britain for a very long time, because Constantine was a Christian. He'd been brought up as a Christian by his mother. And at this Council of Arles, they all got together and they said that they would choose George of Lydda, Constantine's old friend, to be chosen as the model and example for the young manhood of Christendom. And Constantine actually built 21 churches that were dedicated to St. George. Coeur de Lion rebuilt one of them in Jerusalem, and that was still standing about 150 years ago. I don't know if it still is now. There was part of the wall that was still there. And in Lydda, his tomb was there, and there was a rose there, and the Rose of Sharon was dedicated to St. George, which is why the rose is another one of his symbols. And there's confusion, as I was saying, about how about St. George. The confusion with him is this fake George of Cappadocia was this worthless Arian bishop of Alexandria, and he was actually lynched by his church because he robbed them and treated them really badly. And some people will try and say that's the St. George. And Constantine the Great, there was another Constantine 35 years before him that was Constantine the Tyrant. So the atheistic Jewish revisionist today will try and tell you that St. George was this fake, this bishop of Alexandria. And they'll also try and tell you that Constantine was this complete tyrant. It's complete lies, because they try to, they want to do away with Celtic history, really. They don't want people to know about the British history. And they also called him Chief of the Galileans. And Julian the Apostate, he also referred to the Christians as the Galileans, and so did Flavius Josephus, which I think really, you know, differentiates between Jews and Galileans. This was the original word for the Christians, were the Galileans. And he was seen as the chief of the Galileans. And then after that, you've got King Arthur, who again was from the line of King Constantine. And he honoured and venerated St. George. And then obviously Coeur de Lion did, and the Crusaders. I mean, their battle cry was for St. George. And we still say, by George, today.
By George.
By George, old boy. Yes, it's still current, these words. And yet, actually, the celebration of St. George, we're not really allowed to have them because they say it encourages nationalism, and obviously it upsets the Muslims for us to have any patriotism. And the Muslims have even tried to hijack St. George and say that he's theirs. The Turks have tried to claim him as one of theirs. Whereas we had Mama's Plays, and it was St. George and the Turk. And the Turk would try to steal a white woman for a sex slave, and St. George would kill him. But there's more I can go into, but perhaps I should offer it up to you for some comments on that before I go any further, Subal.
Oh, well, I don't know what to say. I mean, all I can say is that all of our culture comes from the Middle East, obviously. Comes from Arabia, doesn't it?
Well, yeah,
algebra,
I guess.
Algebra comes from the Arabs. What else? I don't know. I saw it on the TV, they told me. But that's nice. I don't really know what to say. I remember reading... Alan Wilson was talking about this, and he was saying that St. Patrick, who is the patron saint of Ireland, obviously, he came from Wales, and he was a Welshman, and he went over to Ireland in something like 200 AD or something like this, which is, you know, further evidence that Christianity was already present in Wales at that time. I do find it very interesting. I'm not so expert on this subject. All I will say is that I like to read the historical revisionist Alan Wilson. I don't agree with everything that he says. He does have some crazy ideas about comets and things like that. He's a little bit kooky, but two points are very striking to me, and that is firstly the point that the Trojan War, he dates it at 650 BC, and basically around the time of the Enlightenment, they scrubbed this out of history, and they said it was a fake war and it never happened, and blah, blah, blah. And when they took the Trojan War out of European history, then what it did is it just kind of swept the carpet out from the whole of European history, because the Italians, well, the Romans, obviously, they traced their history back to Aeneas. And Virgil talks about this in his poem, the Aeneid. And Aeneas came from the Trojans. So the Romans trace their history back to the Trojans. The British, we trace our history back to the Trojans, because Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of England, it's described that Brutus came over, not directly from Troy. He was a descendant of Aeneas, I think. So he came from Rome. So the idea being that the Trojans, they left Troy, they founded Rome, and then I think Brutus was the grandson or the great-grandson of Aeneas. Then he left Rome, and then he came to England and conquered this country. And also the Frankish kings, they traced their descendants back to the Trojans too. And obviously the Frankish kings created Charles de Martel, who beat the Moors in, 1736, stopped the whole of Europe getting conquered by Islam. His descendant was the great king Charlemagne, who became emperor of Europe in 800 AD. And his dynasty, led to the creation of Germany and France. So you've got Italy, Germany, France, and England. All of them trace their ancestry back to the Trojans. But somewhere in the Enlightenment period, the Trojan War was declared to be non-existent. It was declared to be a fantasy, a fairy story. And by doing this, they just swept the carpet out of European history. And, that's it. So our heritage is very much butchered. That's all I really have to say. That doesn't really relate to King George. But anyway, it's why there's this confusion. It does, yeah, kind of in a broad sense. But it's why there's this confusion. People don't believe King Arthur is real. People don't know that Constantine was British. His mother, Helen, was British. I think she brought the cross over, didn't she, apparently? They don't know that Christianity was in Wales at such an early point. We don't know our history. It's been swept aside. And I'm very dubious about the word Celtic as well. Adam Wilson doesn't seem to think much of it, but he thinks it's just a word that they made up to replace what got destroyed. Like, you have to fill the vacuum with something. But basically, many of the great European nations can trace their ancestry back to the Trojans. Unfortunately, of course, for white nationalists, Hitler was more interested in this quasi-fantastical Hyperborean continent, which I'm not really, and the myth of Atlantis and things like that. And it's a bit more, I don't know, maybe there's something in it, but it seems a little bit more shaky to me. The Trojan ancestry myth or story is a lot more solid. But anyway, so that's it. Yeah.
Well, I think I would disagree with Alan Wilson that it was in the 6th century BC. I think it had to have been earlier than that. I think about the 6th century, 6th century BC, you had the Scythians and the Cimmerians coming into Europe from the Black Sea area, and they ended up being the Saxons, and the Cimmerians ended up being the Cymry and colonizing the Chersonese and becoming the Danes as well. And the British kings, Belinus and Brennus, I believe it were, they went over and took over the Roman Empire. And we had British kings in Denmark, and we had Danish kings in Britain, because they were all part of this this Cymry. And where Alan Wilson talks about the comet, I think that's very credible, because you've got the British race, which managed to defeat Julius Caesar twice, send him packing. I mean, the second time he just got as far as London. That's it. The first time he didn't get anywhere.
It was Nennius. I think it was Nennius, wasn't it? Beat them? I'm not sure.
Maybe. Yeah. Eventually, Caractacus, they took him back in chains, and he was sold out by a traitor. Any time that they did actually win, it was because our kings or our people had been sold out by traitors. But they sent the Romans packing. And then King Constantine, with his British army, managed to take over the empire. And yet, 200 years later, you've got a small force of Saxons that managed to take the whole country.
Mm.
And it just doesn't make sense. I think that's why Alan Wilson's theory with the comet hitting the country, and the evidence for that, and the evidence of nothing growing and all the people moving over to Brittany, I think there may be some truth to that. But
could have been a plague. I mean, that would be a more sensible explanation, some kind of plague. But I don't know. I mean, who knows, right?
I think it caused plague as well. I think they had would have had a plague as well, similar to like radiation maybe. So yeah. I think that would have been a part of it. The way where you were talking there about the Roman ancestry with the Trojans, the Romans actually did away with their royalty. Tarquin, I believe it was. They massacred their royal family. So they didn't actually have a royal family, which is why they would marry in to the British royal family, which is why Constantine's mother, Empress Helena, had married Constantius, the Roman Constantius. He wanted to marry her because her father was King Cole, and his line went back through to this Trojan line. So that, and it wasn't just then, it was these other Romans that were in Britain at the time would marry into the British monarchy because it would give them legitimacy when they wanted to be on the Roman Senate. And this is what they meant by a noble family. You could tell the pedigree. To be a Druid at the time, you had to be able to show you had 10 generations going back of being a free man. You had to show this pedigree. They were very much into their family trees, very much into their eugenics as well. But on top of this, to bring it back to St. George and Constantine, on top of the actual real life of St. George, you've also got these mythical aspects to it as well. You've got the dragon slaying, and there are various legends of that occurring in Britain, that also occurring in Beirut. There's a legend of it occurring in Tripoli, in Libya. And they did.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought it happened in Libya.
Yeah, they did
that
actually.
My understanding.
They had St. George's hand in Libya, and the ISIS crew went and destroyed it. Just destroyed the church of St. George there, destroyed the relics.
Barbarians. Oh, I just. Ugh.
Yeah, they had the saint's hand there. But there are other mythic aspects to it, like St. George is supposed to be the evergreen green one, which goes back to Osiris and before that Ptah, the creator god, and the civilization bringer, and farming and agriculture, and all those legends of these mythic figures, these angels, this green angel or this green god type, ended up being transposed onto St. George as well. I think the Muslims call him Al-Qidr or something like that, because their legends go back, obviously, back to this earlier time as well in the Near East. I mean, it's quite fascinating, I find.
Alan Wilson, he mentions that Britannia, as in the, I don't know, the goddess or the image Britannia, is actually Athena. He says they brought her over. And you can see the similarity. She has a spear, like Athena. Athena is famous for having a spear. And they even say that's where Shakespeare comes from, because Athena shakes her spear like that. But, anyway, that's an interesting...
Well, I think Minerva as well. I mean, L.A. Waddell, I mean, a lot of his stuff...
Yeah, Minerva, that's it. What did I say? Athena? Well, anyway,
Athena.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, well, I think Athena's the same. But L.A. Waddell... Yeah. A lot of his work, I think, it's very hard to substantiate, but some parts of it are truthful. And he shows that this St. George's cross, the equal armed cross, this goes way back. This goes back thousands of years, and the female figure holding the trident with the shield with the cross on it, that goes back a long way as well, and the cross that Constantine supposedly instituted in this sign you will conquer, he supposedly had this dream, and that was the equal armed cross that he was using. The crucifix didn't start being used until about the 7th century, so this cross symbol had been used for a long time. And apparently when Joseph of Arimathea came over to Britain after rescuing Christ's body at the resurrection, putting him in the tomb, and then he was resurrected, he came over to Marseille with Mary Magdalene and Martha, and then he came over to Britain with Lazarus, I think it was, and Eleutherius, this first bishop, and apparently his symbol was the equal armed cross, the red cross, and the cross of St. George was originally the cross of Joseph of Arimathea, and that's right. An old British legend as well.
I have a random question, seeing as you just brought up Jesus. It seems we're talking randomly about history. But I went to a church last week. I went to one of these old National Trust houses, went for a walk in the garden. It was very nice. And they had a little chapel there. And I think it was an Anglican. I don't know what type of chapel it was. What is it? Was it Baptist? No, it was evangelical. Anyway, they said they had some prayer written on the wall. And it said that obviously Jesus, they took him down from the cross, and he was down for 3 days before he arose again. But in this prayer, it said that he went to hell for 3 days. And I've never heard this before. Is this true? Is this biblical, or is this? Do you know anything about this?
Yes, he supposedly went to Hades and released all the souls, all the righteous souls that were in Hades.
Okay,
and that's very interesting.
Is that actually
days.
In the King James Bible, or is it a new interpretation, or is it an ancient interpretation, or
yes, it's in the King James Bible. It's
the original mainstream English. Oh, okay.
Yes, went down into Hades, but it's not hell. It's actually Hades, which is different to hell. I guess the concept of hell has changed over time. Hades or Sheol was just a place that people would go to sleep.
Right.
So that's evolved over time into what it is now.
It's like one of the realms of hell, like I suppose that Dante would describe in his Divine Comedy. It's like part of the underworld, but not the worst part. Is that it?
Yeah, well, no, it's just a place where the souls rested. You know, like when you go to sleep, they just went to sleep there, waiting for the judgment day, I guess. And Jesus descended into Hades and freed them all. Well, freed all the righteous ones that were okay. Asleep there. And yeah, I haven't done that much research into it, but just to bring it back to what you were saying there about Empress Helena and bringing the cross to Britain. She went to Jerusalem and came back to Britain with pieces of the original cross. And while she was in Jerusalem, she built this big church to St. George. Then she came back to Britain and she paraded this cross around the country, around Wales. And we've got places that are named after that. And this history was all known by the British people. Shakespeare knew about this. Everybody knew about this. This was our British heritage. And I think what happened was when the Normans came, they tried to hide it. They would burn the Welsh manuscripts. When the Welsh princes would go into the Tower, they would take all their family trees with them and all the rest of it. And this monk, Anglo-Saxon monk, I think he was, in about the 11th century, he burned the Tower down. It burned down all the libraries with all these manuscripts. And they banned the Welsh from speaking Welsh up until about the 18th, 19th century. I think they even banned them from having printing presses because they didn't want them to keep this history. They wanted to get rid of it all and hide it all. And I think that's what manifests in this idea today that we were just barbarians before the Normans came, as if we didn't know how to put one brick on top of the other, and we were all just living in caves or something.
Yeah, I just want to interject, not that I disagree with what you say, but I saw somebody on the internet, a random comment he made, and he said, "Barbarians means bearded Aryan, as in, you know, barb, as in barber, you know, so beard, and then Aryan, barbarian." I don't know if that's true or not, but I thought it was kind of interesting. I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Well, could well be true. I think the word barbarian, I mean, that's changed over the years, because all that meant was people outside the Roman Empire. Didn't mean that they were savages. Might mean that today. You might use the word barbarian to describe Muslims. But that's because the word itself has evolved over time. It just meant people that lived outside the Roman Empire. I think that could well be right. You know, it's got the word barber
sounds
in
good.
It.
Yeah. I mean, I am a fan of etymology and finding like different meaning. Like the Vikings, VI, six kings. It makes sense, doesn't it? All the Vikings, six kings in Scandinavia. I mean, who knows, but it sounds interesting.
Do they have six kings there?
I don't know, but VI, Vikings.
I guess.
I don't know, there's a lot of random stuff on the internet. I should not throw that out there. But yes, I do totally agree. They squashed the Welsh history. I don't know if that was a Jewish plot or not. I mean, the Normans did bring over the Jews. The Jews do have a habit of destroying history. It seems to be, I don't know, is that a natural thing that they do? Is it biological? Is it just something that they like to do? I don't know. It's possibly. But anyway, from a political point of view, yes, it just makes sense that you want the Scottish to stop rebelling. You want the Welsh to stop rebelling. So what do? You just burn all their history books and suppress their culture. And I think it's a shame because I think Edward Longshanks was in part responsible for it because he conquered Wales, which is a shame because he's also the one that kicked the Jews out. So it's kind of a mixed bag, a hero and a villain at the same time.
Yeah, there's good and bad in him. He was a nationalist. He was a British nationalist. He wanted the nations to come together and fight for Britain and be British. He's also got a bad reputation in Scotland, but I think all that is outweighed by the fact that he removed all the Jews from the country, and everyone in the country donated a penny to reward him for doing so, to buy him a present.
He also threw homosexuals out of windows, so that was
Nice one. These kings we had, you know, I mean, we're taught today that democracy is wonderful and how wrong it was to have somebody above everyone else and how terrible these kings were. But, you know, these kings, most of the time, they were really good. I mean, they would be at the front in the battle. They wouldn't be sending out everyone else to fight while they stayed at home, like we get nowadays with our leaders. And I actually, you know, I've mentioned before about how King Charles I was a great friend to the poor and he was a real hero to the peasants. And I've got the 12 good rules of King Charles here. And King Charles I, he was beheaded January 30th, 1649. This is the first one. Profane no divine ordinances. So that's obey the natural law. Touch no state matters. So don't interfere in the matters of state. Urge no health. So I guess that means don't wish bad health on anyone. Pick no quarrels. Maintain no ill opinions. Encourage no vice. Repeat no grievances. Reveal no secrets. Make no comparisons. Keep no bad company. Make no long meals and lay no wages. These rules observed will obtain thy peace and everlasting gain. Mm. And that was written by Charles I.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I got to say, the more that I get into European history, the more I'm inclined towards the Catholic religion, I have to say. I think our troubles in this country really can be brought back to Henry VIII, who unfortunately destroyed all the monasteries and destroyed all the wealth in this nation and legalized usury, and which ultimately led to bringing the Jews back. And look at the flipping state we're in now. It's a real shame, actually. Yeah, I'm really getting into, I know you're a big fan of E. Michael Jones, but I'm really getting into him as well. He puts a totally different spin on history. For example, he says about Queen Victoria, and the Spanish Armada. And there's me thinking, Queen Victoria's a hero and Sir Francis Drake is a hero. But you listen to Michael Jones and it's like Sir Francis Drake was just a pirate and they were just fighting against the Catholics. I mean, they were fighting against Ferdinand and Isabella and they were, that was a great nation. I mean, that was the nation that kicked the Jews out, for Christ's sake. So, unfortunately, Henry VIII turned this into a Protestant country and then the Jews got invited back in. And then they brought over William of Orange from the Dutch Republic. The Dutch Republic was, of course, just a capitalist creation created by the Jews. Protestant creation, they brought him over, and then they created the Bank of England in 1690, and it's just all been downhill ever since. So I'm not a Christian, but I think if I was, I'd be a Catholic. Although the current Pope, obviously, is not a very good one. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, back then, that was Merry England before Henry
Merry England, yeah.
Merry England, yeah. If you look up Bishop Williamson, he's done some excellent lectures on this subject, which is in line with what E. Michael Jones talks about. And I think Catholicism, it did do a lot of good. I think people misrepresent it today. They misrepresent the way that the church didn't want wanted to have an official translation of the Bible. They wanted to keep it in Latin so that it didn't actually lose anything in the translation, and they were worried that the Jews were going to be printing up their own translations and publishing them, which is what they did. There are things wrong with the Catholic Church, but it did give a structure to everything, and it did ensure, or tried to ensure, that the kings were all upstanding and virtuous Catholic people, and they would excommunicate these kings if they weren't. So they sort of, I think it helped to, definitely helped to keep the kings in order. What was I going to say then? It was about the...
Can I ask you a question? On.
Yeah,
sure. Because I'm reading right now, I just started reading Libido Dominandi by E. Michael Jones, and which is, it's called Sexual Liberation and Political Control. And he talks about the sexual revolution and you know, how you use sexuality to dominate the masses is very interesting. But he starts around about, well, he starts with the formation of the Illuminati by Adam Weishaupt, the Bavarian Illuminati, which was founded in 1776, or May Day, I think, interestingly enough. So he kind of starts there. But just before he starts there, what he does mention that the kings of Europe were harassing the Pope, and they asked the Pope to suppress the Jesuits. And I haven't looked into it. He doesn't talk about it in depth, but he says that the kings of Europe suppressed the Jesuits. And he basically, he seems to be saying that it was because the Jesuit order was suppressed that this revolutionary spirit was, you know, broke free. And he said it was the Jesuits which were keeping this under control. So my question is, the Jesuits, obviously they were formed as part of the Counter-Reformation in 1540, I think it was, by, mine's going blank. What's his name?
Loyola, Ignatius Loyola, was it?
Yeah, Ignatius Loyola, who is a Murano Jew. So yeah, that's my question. What is your opinion on the Jesuits? Were they a force of good? Were they a force of evil? Because I mean, I'm an old school conspiracy theorist. I mean, I got into Alex Jones and all that lot, but I'm re-looking at these things now, because a lot of the conspiracy theory, which is on the internet, seems to be emanating out of America. And a lot of it seems to be emanating from, you know, Christian Americans who are obviously Protestants, and they hate the Catholic Church, and they say blah blah blah, the Black Pope, the Jesuits, they're evil. And now I'm a little bit confused, because I've never really read into the subject. Were the Jesuits a force of good? Were they a force of evil? I'm not sure. So what's your opinion, Sven?
Well, I think you get a much more balanced view from looking at E. Michael Jones stuff and Michael Hoffman and Bishop Williamson, as well as looking at what comes out from the Protestant side about it. For a start, that will give you a more balanced view. And I think that Ignatius Loyola, and that shows you that there are always exceptions to the rule. When we say that there are no good Jews, that is basically the rule. But every so often you get one that you know, isn't as bad as the rest, I guess. Benjamin Friedman would be another one. There's one at the moment who I can't remember the name of it, a revisionist at the moment that Alison Chablow talks about. Well, David Cole, I mean, he started out well, but he seems to have gone back on a lot of what he was saying, and he was particularly degenerate when he was the party animal for the Republican Party. And the Jesuits, I think, that, from what I know, they have a fantastic education system, and people that have been educated at Jesuit schools have had a really good education. And there are a lot of people on our side that were educated at these Jesuit schools. I think it probably started out with good intentions, probably with looking out for Jewish influence more than anything else, preventing Jewish influence, preventing Judaizing. The Inquisition was, in particular, was to root out these Jews, these fake Jews, the ones that are claiming that they were Christians but were still carrying out the orders from the Talmud. So I think it started out in a good way, but it may well have become corrupted over time, because everything's become corrupted over time. I mean, the church started out good, and look at the establishment churches today. Our monarchy and our forms of government started out well. And now look at our forms of government today, and look at how degenerate and taken over they are. Yeah, I think when you get Jews involved with something, they gradually corrupt it and take it over. And even if you look at Judea at the time of Christ, you've got these Edomian Jews, these Canaanite Jews, and within 200 years they had managed to take over the priesthood, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and they'd even got one of their own on the throne. The monarch, Herod the Great, was one of these Edomian Canaanites. And they then became known as the Jews. They developed Judaism. But even
Herod
back
was
then,
a Canaanite.
Yeah, he was an Edomian. He was of ignoble birth. His mother was an Edomian Canaanite.
And that's why he helped build the Second Temple. That's why they call it Herod's Temple.
Herod's Temple. Yeah, that's why the Jews call him Herod the Great. And that's why the temple was destroyed. It was built by a Canaanite. Yeah, and anyone that came into Judea could become a Jew, basically. It just meant a citizen. So what happened was, 250 years before Christ, John Hyrcanus went to war against these Idumean Canaanites, and instead of wiping them all out, he said, if you all get circumcised, you can interbreed with us, and we'll call you Jews, and we'll all be Jews together. And they didn't just do it with these thousands of, hundreds of thousands of Idumeans. They did it to anyone. They would go out trying to convert people to Judaism, this warped religion that eventually became the Talmud, the stuff that they picked up, this tribe of Judah had picked up in Babylon, basically. And they called them proselytes of the gate, or proselytes of justice. And they basically all became Jews together, this multicultural Roman state of Judea. And the Idumean ones, the Idumean Canaanites, the ones with the Canaanite blood, managed to take everything over, all the institutions, so much so that Herod, who was one of these, was the monarch. He actually took over the kingship. And these were the Jews. These were the ones that Christ called the sons of the devil and the synagogue of Satan, and not all Israel is Israel. All of these quotes are referring to that. After the resurrection of Christ, you've got the Galileans, who were the Christians, and then you've got the Jews, who were the ones that were rejected by Christ, these Canaanites, who then went and wrote down their traditions of men, which became the Talmud, and then they developed Judaism. The religion of the Old Testament revolves around the temple, sacrifices, and a priesthood. And all of them were done away with when the temple was destroyed, and the Romans went in there and they destroyed the temple. And the Jews at the time that were in Jerusalem when Titus and Vespasian went in there, they were destroying the place themselves. It was the Romans who had tears in their eyes at destroying the place, because it was such a jewel of the ancient world. But they really didn't want these Jews to be revolting in the way that they were. And the Jews couldn't care less that the temple was being destroyed and that Jerusalem was being destroyed. They really couldn't care less. And they went on after that to start revolutions wherever they went. So they were eventually kicked out of Judea. But they've done exactly the same thing today. We've invited them into Europe, and they've basically slowly infiltrated everything, took over the banks, took over the government, took over the media, and now we've got their bloodline on the throne. Or we will have their bloodline on the throne. I mean, Lady Diana, she was Jewish. So all
was she?
She's got Jews in her bloodline.
Oh, I didn't know that. I knew that.
And Goldsmith. Goldsmith, or whatever her name is, Princess Kate.
Yeah, Kate Middleton. Middle Jew, whatever. Yeah, she's a Jew.
So we're going to have Jews on the throne again, 2,000 years later. But they've always done the same thing. I mean, E. Michael Jones is fantastic the way he documents it, because he goes right from the revolution in Jerusalem when the temple was destroyed, and then every single one since, in the Jewish revolutionary spirit and its impact on world history.
Yeah.
So with the Jesuits,
it basically is European history. It's You can't understand European history unless you understand the Jewish story, because they're the ones that just have torn Europe to pieces. Unfortunately, it's unfortunately our history is just intertwined with them.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, I mean, they took over the Jesuits as well. They infiltrated that and took that over. And the very people that are telling us our history now are Jews. Just about every single history program that you see on the television will be presented by a Jew. If you look at programs on Christianity, it will be presented by a Jew. So our history has been completely warped from what it was, and it's being told in a way that is philo-Semitic.
It does seem to be one of their tactics to rewrite things. I mean, I have to mention, this is also happening in the Hare Krishna movement, I have to say, because obviously Prabhupada, he came to the West in the 60s. He got a bunch of Jewish disciples. They poisoned him, took over the movement, became the gurus, and they're basically rewriting his books. They've been rewriting his books for the last 30 years. People have been complaining about it. There's a whole legal battle going back and forth with people trying to you know, reprint Prabhupada's books as they actually were, but they just, you know, these people are like, they rewrite stuff. They just change it. They, you know, they're such a bunch of crazy people, you know, and it's biological. That's the thing. It's biological because these Jews in the Hare Krishna movement, they never went to synagogues. They never grew. I mean, obviously the first generation did, but the generation that's, you know, in power now, they were raised in devotee families, but they were raised as Hare Krishnas from birth, but they have this mentality. It just comes out. It's just, it's very interesting. This is why I wanted to ask you about Ignatius Loyola, because Michael Jones at the beginning of this book, Libido Dominandi, he's talking about how Adam Weishaupt, he established the Illuminati, and he's saying how he established the Illuminati using Jesuit techniques of mind control that were established, you know, by Ignatius Loyola. And Adam Weishaupt, he took these mind control techniques that Ignatius Loyola had created to have a real strict discipline, real, really, really strict Christian discipline. And he took that and instead used it to create this secret cult, the Illuminati, where you had this heavy atheistic mind control discipline, which was all mixed in with sexuality and weirdness. And E. Michael Jones is basically saying that the Illuminati was the foundation for all modern systems of mind control. It's like the communist mind control, the mass media mind control that we have today. It's all basically coming down from the Illuminati, and it comes itself from Ignatius Loyola. That's why I find it so fascinating, because it seems like Ignatius Loyola was definitely a sincere Christian, but because he has this Jewish biology, he approaches Christianity in a completely different way, creates this spiritual system of like Christian mind control, which is just full of, I don't know, lots and lots of different rules and regulations, and you have to follow this, you have to follow that. It's very much like the Talmud, you know, it's just like a book full of rules, rules upon rules upon, do this, do that. It's like madness. And I see the same thing in the Hare Krishna movement. Like these Jews, they miss the essence. They miss the love and affection that's there. They just kind of miss that entirely. And they create this very harsh version of the Hare Krishna movement, which is why I'm sure many of the listeners, they've met devotees on the street and they're getting harassed for money, right? They meet some Hare Krishna on the street that's trying to flog them a book and won't leave them alone. Why are they doing that? It's because the Jews run the movement. They've put their Jewishness into it. And in the 80s, after they poisoned Prabhupada and they took over, the movement became infamous for just really, really harsh, heavy rules and regulations, a complete lack of love and affection. So their biology just drives them to be fanatics. I mean, also, I have to say further, I was reading on the internet, if you listen to what the Iranians say and Hezbollah, they say that Wahhabi himself was a Jew. And all this Wahhabi Islam, which is obviously the crazy form of Islam, which you know, it's inspiring all this terrorism today. Not that I'm letting Muhammad off the hook, but, you know, the Wahhabi Islam is especially extreme. I mean, they're not even allowed to sing songs for Allah. I mean, they're not even allowed to dance. It's just, it's nuts, you know. This Wahhabi, they're saying that Wahhabi, the preacher who established this form of Islam, was also a Jew. And maybe, was he a Jewish agent or was he a sincere Jew which converted to Islam? I don't know, but you see the same nature there. This, like, they come into a religion, they have this obsession with rules and regulations. They totally miss the love and affection aspect of the religion and just create this harsh version of it. So, yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah.
Well, I think blood will always triumph, whether it's in the second generation, third generation. And we see that today with the Muslims in Europe that are going out, carrying out these terrorist acts, or the ones that have gone off to be jihadis in Syria. I mean, some of them are third generation Muslims that have been in Europe all that time, and they're families first came to Europe and were wearing suits and ties, and two or three generations later, and they're all wandering around in their pyjamas and blowing themselves up all over the place and beheading people, because the blood will always triumph. So you may get you may get a decent Ignatius Loyola, but I dare say two or three generations down the line, his offspring are all the same as the rest of these Jews. And as far as these mind control techniques or self-discipline, I would suggest that you really need self-discipline if you're going to resist the Jewish temptations that are put before them. If they were part of the Inquisition and searching out the Judaizers and searching out the deceivers, then they would need to be really self-disciplined. They would need some regiment, you know, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, doing your prayers and all this self-discipline that's involved to keep them on the straight and narrow. So maybe that was the origin of that. And then it was, as happens to all things, it then gets used for negative purposes by this Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminati. Because if anyone knew what these Jews were like, it would be Ignatius Loyola. That was why he became the leader of the Jesuits, because he knew what these Jews were like. There was another one, Pfefferkorn, I think his name was, and he was another converso Jew, and he was the one that was trying to get the Pope to destroy all the copies of the Talmud, and the Pope was refusing to do it, and this Pfefferkorn was really doing his best to get these copies destroyed. Right. This is about the time of
1240, Luther.
It was about the time of Martin Luther, because Martin Luther was really enamoured with the Jews at first. He thought they were fantastic, and they were helping him with translations and telling him how to interpret the Bible. And then eventually, near the end of his life, he realised the truth, and he wrote On the Jews and Their Lies. And you know, if you see a synagogue, destroy it. You know, it's your duty. If you see a Jew, you know, then a crime's taken place. It was really, really, really harsh wording. Yeah. And of course, the Lutherans today, that most of them are not even aware that this book exists. But this was his final view on the subject. And it was all happening around the same time with his Pfefferkorn and with these Muranos and crypto Jews. So you had some of them were good, and they were exposing the Talmud, and they were exposing the Jews and exposing what went on in the synagogues. But 99% of them were pretending to be Christian, or pretending to go along with the Christian laws, I should say, so that they could be elevated in their positions in the establishment and take over the establishment, which is what's happened today, and which is exactly what happened in Judea. Just to take it back to where I was originally saying about this way that they operate. And it is entirely biological, and it's parasitical as well. If you look at some of these parasites that exist, you get ones that will take over an organism. You get some that will work their way into the eyes of a snail, and they'll steer the snail around. You've got other ones that will take over a crab, and they'll change the sex of the crab. They'll make the male crab behave like a female and look like a female. The parasites manage to work their way up to the higher functions of the organism, and then they take over those higher functions of the organism and cause the organism to come out with behavior that is extremely harmful to it. And this is what we see them take over the establishment and then institute all these ideas and policies that are deadly harmful to the organism, deadly harmful to the nation, inviting in all these other different peoples, different races into the nation, encouraging miscegenation with them, allowing them to take part in our democracy and allowing their vote to count as much as our vote. All of this is really harmful to the organism. And that's the way that they've been for as far back as we can trace them in history. So it is a biological trait that they have. But I think what by looking at it and identifying that, we can learn about our own biological traits, which is like the antibodies to that, how to resist that. Mm. We're not miscegenated mongrels. We are pure, and they are impure, and we have the ability to resist their temptations. They don't have the ability to resist them. They're just working to a plan. This is why they overreach themselves. I mean, they're really overreaching themselves at the moment, aren't they? They're identifying themselves. Whenever they accuse somebody of anti-Semitism, when somebody hasn't even spoken about Jews, but they've talked about banks or the media, and they accuse them of anti-Semitism, that's because they don't know anything. They don't know how to do anything else. And that identifies them to the world as being the ones running the banks, running the media. And we saw that with the Trump campaign, didn't we?
Yeah. I don't know, I'm feeling a bit black-pilled today, but yeah, they have overreached, and people are waking up, and they've certainly lost control of the internet. I mean, you just got to flick around and look at the comment sections on the YouTube or just about anywhere. I mean, it's all the general mass of people on the internet does seem to be turning a bit hard right. So, it's just unfortunate that Trump has just turned into a complete and utter cuckold. He's even given amnesty to the Mexicans now. But anyway, I mean, they say politics is downstream from culture. So, hopefully things will change for the better.
Well, I think things may change for the better by the time this podcast is published. And we've got the French presidential election today. I've got high hopes for Marine Le Pen.
Yeah.
Praying for her. Remember her?
Well, I will say that when we had the Brexit vote, I didn't think we'd win, and we won. And when we had the Trump vote, I didn't think we'd win, and we won. And with Marine Le Pen, I don't think we're going to win. So maybe that means we're going to win. I don't know.
Well, she certainly seems better than Trump. I mean, she's condemned him for going into Syria. She's condemned him for not forcing the Muslim ban through. She has said she wants to stop all immigration. Not just immigration from Muslim countries, all immigration. She seems a lot more racial nationalist than Donald Trump does. So I really hope that she does get in. We've also got UKIP today. They're saying that they want to ban all full face veils, and they're not going to contest any seats where the person standing in the election, which is going to be taking place on June the 8th, they're not going to contest any seats where the candidate has been pro-hard Brexit, which is good. And we've been saying for a long time, nationalists should not be contesting seats where there are other nationalists that are likely to win the vote. And, okay, UKIP aren't ethnic nationalists, but they are civic nationalists. And you know, this is a good thing that they're doing there. So there's a couple of things.
It does seem to me to be the solution to have some kind of coalition, because especially for, you know, if you're a white nationalist, you can't really, I mean, we've got no money, have we? We can't just go flying around the country, you know, talking to people all over the country. You can probably get away with it in your own small constituency. And just because people, it seems to me, white nationalists in this country, they all seem to fall out and the political parties split up and they don't get along. So it does seem to be the obvious solution, just to have a grand coalition of all the different groups. That would be the best solution.
Definitely. Yeah. And bringing up money there and coming near to the end of the podcast, don't forget to donate to Morgos Review, and you can also donate to Radio Aryan. And I think just since we've been talking about St. George's Day, or St. George for this podcast, I think we can look at the example of St. George. He stuck by the truth right until the very end. He refused to recant, he was tortured, he was beheaded, but then after his death, we're still talking about him today. He's been immortalized by that. We still have St. George's Day today. All those churches were named after him. He was the example to all the young manhood and chivalry of Christendom. We still say by George today. He was the inspiration in the Crusades. So, you know, it's worth standing up for the truth. It's worth standing up for the truth and not giving in to the liars and the people that are trying to push you into lying or compromising. Don't compromise. St. George is the example of not compromising. So I think people can go away with that thought about him from this podcast. So, Seabold, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back on the same day, same time, same place next week on Radio Aryan. We hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll see you all again next time.
You are listening to Radio Aryan. For an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.